The question is whether we have a talk about this hotel or hotels generally. And I'll tell you a story about a lady called Mrs. Pickering. Mrs. Pickering was Eileen McHenry. The McHenrys had a big business in Brisheen Street in Ballymena. And she married Sidney Pickering and had a child. Forget what his name was, but anyhow, but both he and her son is dead. And they're both dead. And she's about 90 years of age, where she was at school with my mother. And she's lived in Hull for years. But about 6 years ago, she rang suddenly, and she said who she was, and I knew who she was. And she said, "I'm coming to Ireland." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "I'm going to stay the first night in the Midland in Belfast." I said, "No, you'll not. It hasn't been there for 30 years. "Well, then I'll go on to Larne and stay in the King's Arms." "No, it's a shopping centre." "What about the Laharna?" "Well," I said, I was past it last week, and there's nothing but a pile of bricks in a wheelbarrow in the middle of the site. What am I going to do?" And I said, "You'll just have to come on, dear, come on to Cushion Dun." So that lady, she's 90 years of age, and I'm setting the context because she would be a lady who came to hotels in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and 50s, and she had a certain style with her. You know what hotels were for, I suppose. There used to be the great ones like the Shelburne and in Dublin, the Grand Central and Belfast, Cruises in Limerick and the Granville in Waterford and so on. They were sort of surrogate big houses. In the old days, people from big houses wandered around the various houses, they had nothing else to do, and they were thoroughly bored, and the families visited each other in the style to which they were accustomed, of course. Well, then, if they couldn't do that, they wanted to stay in a hotel. Well, that theme runs through a lot of hotels, because they like them to be palatial, and they like them to be served, and looked after, and cosseted, and bring their servants even with them in some cases. And you even have an extension of that in things like the Orient Express and the cruise liners. That was holidays for the grand in those days. And there were, of course, other hotels. There were some seaside hotels, like, say, the Glens of Antrim and Cushendall or the Londonderry Arms and things like that. But really, these big hotels were the thing to stay in. There were also railway hotels. There was the LMS, there was the Midland, of course, was a railway hotel. That was to boost railway trade, of course. And there was the Northern Counties Hotel in Ross Trevor, the great southern hotels there's one at Parknassilla and there's one in Galway and so on. But hotels had their day. There's the rise and fall of hotels, and now they're sort of gone, because Mrs. Pickering asked about innumerable hotels. And I'll read out some of the names of hotels in Larne, for example, in 1932. This is MacDonald's Irish Directory. And there were in Larne the Castle Hotel in Main Street. Maybe it wasn't much of a hotel. The Eagle Hotel, somewhere else, and Station Road. There was the Halfway House Hotel in Ballygally, of course. The King's Arms Hotel, the Laharna Hotel, the Lancashire and Yorkshire Hotel in Main Street, the Lochview Hotel in Curran Street. The Main Street Hotel that's advertised. The Older Fleet Hotel at Larne Harbour. The Queen's Arms in Cross Street. The Royal Hotel in Cross Street. The Seaview in Curran Street. And the Towers Hotel in Curran Street. Curran Street seems to be the place to have a hotel in Larne. There were, in addition to that, the Ballygally Castle. I've mentioned that. The Antrim Arms in Glenarm, which is a very old hotel. The Londonderry Arms, which I mentioned. There was Macaulay's Hotel in Carnlough, the Garn Tower Hotel, belonged to the McNeils, the Cushendall Hotel, the Glens of Antrim Hotel, and there's a couple more listed in the Ulster Tourist Development Association. The Glenville Hotel, the Thornley Hotel, Spence's Hotel, and Lynn's Hotel in Cushendall. All of those. And think what's there now. In Cushendun, there was the Bay Hotel, the Glendun Hotel, and the Cushendun Hotel, this one. There was the Marine Hotel, the Antrim Arms Hotel, the Boyd Arms Hotel, the Royal Hotel in Ballycastle, and others probably too, along the seafront, and there's Fullerton Arms and Cain's Causeway and Cain's Royal Hotel. All those hotels, there were dozens of the things, and they have largely disappeared. So, one of the interesting things is the names of hotels. An awful lot of them are Royal Hotel. Imperial Hotel is a very favourite one all over the country, and they also have the Grand. And finally, there's the question of the Arms. There are Arms everywhere. It's probably back to this theme of the surrogate big house. They like to have some sort of contact with the aristocracy to show how elegant and what they are and what the ambience is. And to mention a few, there was the Adair Arms in Ballymena for the Adair family. And Belfast had a Shaftesbury Arms. Armagh had the Beresford Arms and the Charlemont Arms. Antrim had the Massarine Arms. The Coleraine had the Corporation Arms. Dungannon had the Northland Arms. Kilray had the Mercer's Arms. Strabane the Abercorn Arms. And I guess there was the Boyd Arms, the two Antrim Armses, and the Londonderry Arms. And I remember somebody telling me from the family that when Mrs. McBride, my grandmother who started this hotel, was going to name her hotel, she made a statement, there will be no arms or legs here. It's a bit like the statement somebody said one time, we were naming a playing pitch somewhere, we're having neither priests nor patriots. Anyhow, in 1925, Mrs. McBride got round to starting her hotel. She'd had this thing in her mind for a long time, some years. And the difficulties facing you in those days in a place like Cushendun was, well, the remoteness. There was no public transport and there weren't that many cars. There was no electricity, no mains electricity. There was no mains water, there was no mains sewer, and there was no particular marketing. And what she eventually had to deal with was, well, she had to get some activities going, some reason to come here. She had to get it licensed. She had to get not only the water, but hot and cold in bedrooms. As things grew, as things developed over the years, things that people looked for were interior sprung mattresses, electric light. They liked separate tables. They wanted a night porter. They also wanted a garage and some connection with motoring organisations, because when motoring did start, they wanted to be fit to put their car under cover. Some people had petrol pumps. There was a petrol pump, for example, down at the Glen Dun down there. And as I say, they wanted the elegance. They required the elegance. And how was this to be done? Well, I'll go over the thing. The bones of the hotel were that it was a converted mill. And if you read Malachy's article in the Glynn's, if you can rake it up, you'll find out about the particular mill that was here. This whole range of buildings, this and the old Glen Dun nursing home, were one mill. They were built about 1860 and sometime after that. It was a Crumlin, sort of a Crumlin project. I'll not say how closely it was allied to them. It muddles up with the Finlays and Benjamin Maxwell and all sorts of people. It doesn't really matter because it was too big for the output of the district and eventually it became derelict and Mrs. McBride bought the site. Now already the lower end, down towards the new tenements, had been turned into a hotel, the Anchorage Hotel by Morris Finlay, and was trading. So Mrs. McBride was coming onto ground that had already to some extent been trod. She bought the building here, she bought the remains of it, and it was a substantial building but substantially derelict. This particular room here was the furnace hall and the engine room, and there were drive shafts up and down through the buildings on two levels. There was a collection of activities like scutching and rope making and corn grinding and goodness knows what else. It was a commercial project at the time it was started and employed quite a lot of people, but all that had died. When she built her hotel, she opened it on the 15th of November 1925. I presume that's when it was ready. And the first customers were the Sloanes. Isabel Sloan came here until about 15 years ago every year from that time. And she had come because her brother had supplied some of the materials required for the construction. The hotel was lighted by oil lamps and candles. Can you imagine lighting the place with oil lamps and candles? You had to light the lamps every night, and there was paraffin oil everywhere, and people dripped candle grease all over the place, and all you could imagine happened from that. The difficulty with transport, there was no public transport. Water for drinking and cooking was taken from a spring well. And there was a hot and cold supply for toilets at the top of the stairs and also for one bathroom, the kitchen and dishwashing and cleaning. The supply was pumped. There is under that floor there, approximately the back third of it, has underneath it a tank, a water tank, which is actually full tonight. It is covered over by a concrete cover reinforced by railway lines. I only saw it once. The floor there had rotted and that part had to be taken up, and that was the first time I realised how it was held together. I had seen it before. There used to be a trap door. You could have gone down into it, but I had that all covered up because I had something in my head that somebody sometime might murder somebody and get rid of their body down there. So I sealed it up completely. The sewage system didn't connect with the main sewers. It went straight out into the river, which everybody else did too. She wasn't the only one who did that. The interesting thing was that further down the river there was a pipe which came in, and there was a pump down in what's now the garage, what used to be the old garage, and that was pumped up into a hot water system further down to provide, but to get what was called seawater into a domestic hot water system which provided what they called hot and cold seawater baths. That was one of the attractions at the seaside. Well, I mean, they'd pumped water up out of a river below a sewer and they heated it there and you get into a bath, and that was hot and cold seawater baths. Anyhow, Mrs. McBride had these problems with the mains water supply, and it wasn't until 1930, 5 years after she opened her hotel, that a public water supply was provided in Cushion Dun. But in the meantime, she had tried to solve the problem herself by employing a miner from Park Moor. Up the back of the hotel, she got a diviner, and he said there's water there. The miner spent 6 months digging a hole, and that was all that ever happened. And the only thing ever came out of it was, well, nothing came out of it except the rock, but the only thing ever went into it was, I remember Jim Archie losing a cow down it one time. But apart from that, it didn't produce water. She got the water supply, the mains water with pressure and all that, those sort of interesting things, in 1931. And in 1935, in another way, she upgraded her plumbing system to provide hot and cold running water in every bedroom. Now, that was quite an advance in those days. So by 1935, she could actually advertise a trio of modern attributes: hot and cold water in all bedrooms. She bought interior sprung mattresses, and she got electric light. Well, you'll hear about that later on too. But that was her own system. The hotel at the beginning had 16 bedrooms, 2 toilets, 1 bathroom, 1 residence dining room, and 1 public sitting room. It also had a private sitting room and an extra dining room. The private sitting room apparently was a thing that you could hire. You could hire your room, and you could hire a private sitting room, not en suite or not attached, not a suite, you know, but it still was your private area. And the family themselves, the McBride family themselves, didn't live in the hotel, and there's still no domestic accommodation in this building. They lived over in their home over on the other side of the bridge, over where what's called McBride's pub is, what I call McFake's, because it's a fake McBride's. She had, in fact, also, later on, she bought what is now where the blue room is now, down below. She bought that about 1927. This section here, from that up towards the bridge, was her first hotel. Down there was Macaulay's grocer shop, and she filled this bit in the middle. This then became an intervening bit that was built in, and that gave her over 30 rooms. And 3 bathrooms, 4 toilets, and this particular function room here. They call this the function room. They used to actually call it the big hall, but I tried to get away from that name by calling it the rope room. I don't know whether it's ever stuck or not. People want to call it the big hall. And of course, she had the garage built down below because everybody wanted a garage. That was always to it. Now, she had to get her hotel licensed, and she applied in 1927 for a license. What she had originally intended to do was, she intended to extinguish a license or transfer a license which she had bought, effectively, to here and get her hotel licensed. How she had done that was, she bought the residue of the lease in the second pub in the village, which was where Levy's shop later was and is now occupied by Eddie Dalton. It's across from Mrs. Rainey's, on the other side of the street from Mrs. Rainey's. She bought that in 1909, and she was advised by her solicitor that she would get a renewal of the lease. It was a lease for 3 lives. And the trouble was, the third life fell. The person died 3 years later, and she did not get a renewal. So that meant that, in fact, she lost her money and she lost her license and she lost everything. So she had to start all over again. And she applied for a liquor license. She didn't get her liquor license. So she... but 1927, there was a particular public event here which consisted of Lord Craigavon and various other dignitaries from the government. They did a tour of Northern Ireland and they came here and they had their dinner here, and there was a meeting of local people, local councillors and so on, met here. The subject was the improvement of the Tor Road, but anyhow, she got Craigavon's ear and she told him about her difficulties, and he told her to apply at the next licensing session, which she did, and she got her license. There's of course no question of undue influence involved in the thing. Well, over the years, of course, many rooms have been appropriate to other uses. More bathrooms have been made, and I live in a couple of rooms, and we finish up with now only 17 guest rooms. And as far as I'm concerned, the fewer people are in it, the better. Now, we have to get the ambience. Right, it's a surrogate big house. So when Mrs. McBride was furnishing her hotel, she availed of the auction rooms in Belfast, particularly Ross's. There was much material coming on the market after the First World War from what had been stately homes and big houses, and they were selling out and you could buy things, you see. And she bought a lot of that equipment, and a whole lot of it was never used. A lot of it went down the river, because I found the river's a very useful thing for getting rid of things like mattresses and so on. It's amazing how you can get rid of things if you really try. But there are some interesting things. There's... In the drawing room, there's a bookcase which I purchased actually from Glenmona Gate Lodge. It belonged to Captain Dan McNeil, a cousin of Lord Cushion Dunn. There's also a table which came from Galgorm Castle. That bookcase there dates from 1780. I don't know where it came from, but in any case, it's a thing you wouldn't have in the average bungalow. The only place you could put rubbish like that is in here, and it's crumbling underneath. There's a sofa in the drawing room which came from the hall of the High Court in Belfast. They were throwing it out, and somebody acquired it for Mary McBride, and eventually a certain gentleman asked me if they could have the bones of it when it was decrepit. He wanted to have it restored. He got it restored, paid £250 to have it restored, and found he couldn't get it into his bloody bungalow, and then he had to sell it to me. There are pictures about the place. Those pictures there, of course, are McNaughton's. They're quite nice pictures. There are other ones in the drawing room, other ones in the dining room. If there had been less people here, I'd have taken people on a tour of the building, but there really are too many people to mill about the place. And anyhow, you have a busy night ahead of you. The other things that Mrs. McBride got was a very comprehensive range of cutlery and plate. It was all hotel plate silver. It included vegetable dishes, milk jugs, sugar bowls, cutlery, ranging from fish knives to sugar tongs, butter knives, egg spoons, knives, forks, everything. And I can tell you, in fact, there were teapots and water jugs, all nicely printed with Cushion Dunn Hotel on them and others, all very elegant, all had to be cleaned every week, of course. I can tell you there's nearly none left, because a hotel is a supermarket without tills. Now, one of the things that came on, in any case, in 1934 or so, when she still looked for things to improve her hotel a bit, was the Minnewaska. The Titanic was built in 1912. The Minnewaska was built by Harland and Wolff in 1922. I think it's maiden voyage in 1923 for the American Transport Line. There were actually four of them: the Minnehaha, the Minnecada, the Minnetonka, and the Minnewaska. And the Minnewaska was a huge thing. It was about 23,000 tons of a turbine steamer, and it plied the Atlantic for a while. It had 365 or 368 cabins, and also a huge cargo carrying capacity. And well, at that time, or after the war, or before the war, before the First World War, it was the time for cruise liners. But these people were too late in the business. That fashion was fading, and it was not a commercial success. Eventually, they sold their ship to the Red Star Line, now not the White Star Line, the Red Star Line, who ran it for a year from Antwerp to New York, and then they laid it up, and in 1934, it was broken up in Glasgow. Mrs. McBride took herself to it. Now, it was a luxury liner, at least the passenger element of it was a luxury liner. So she went and she bought a lot of this stuff, which resembles the kind of stuff you might see in pictures from the Titanic. The trouble again was she bought a whole lot of stuff that never was used, just put in old houses up the back, and it crumbled away and eventually got burned. But, for example, that overmantel fire surround was in the ballroom of the Minnewaska. It had a mirror in it, of course, until such times as somebody put a tilly lamp too near the mirror and broke it. Those lights resemble portholes. That's why they resemble portholes, because they were from the Minnewaska. There are beds upstairs with hooks on them, on the side of them, to keep them from sliding out from the wall. Well, the hotel isn't falling that fast yet, so the hooks are redundant. The floor down in the bar, it's an oak block floor. It was also from the ballroom of the Minnewaska. And there was a certain amount, the panelling, the blue room, or what I call the Rope Park Bar, the blue room, the panelling around it is mixed from the first and second class dining saloon of the Minnewaska. There were all sorts of other things like electric wall heaters, which weren't very useful if you didn't have electric light yet. And there were also the wrong voltage. They were slightly lower. They're about 200 volts, I think, or something like that. There was all sorts of other bits and pieces. Some bits and pieces were put up the back, as I say, and they were lost. Now, anyhow, that was part of the business of producing your big house ambience. Now, the transport problem was another one. There were no buses. But eventually, Mrs. McBride managed to solve that in a roundabout way. When the bus company, the Parkmore Railway was still running, and you could get transported to Cushion Doyle, you could get transported out, and you could also get transport along the coast from Larne in a sort of half-hearted way. But a bus service was being introduced. Unfortunately, the bus service is all radiated, or nearly all radiated, from Ballymena, and they were intended to come somewhere. Well, they were coming to Cushion Doyle, and they weren't coming to Cushion Doyle. And Mrs. McBride eventually coaxed them and bribed them to come to Cushion Doyle by the expedient of building for them a garage out at the end of the hotel, which would hold their two buses at night, and there could be garage there. And that was how she got the bus company to extend their service to Cushion Doyle, so she had them coming to Cushion Doyle. Let me see now. What have I missed? Lighting. Well, as I said, there was no public power supply in 1925, and that was quite normal in the country. Only large towns had it, and they were all run by private companies. One of the things that people have said, I don't know whether it's right or not, is that the first hotel lighted in Ireland was the Causeway Hotel, and that is an adjunct to the Causeway Tram, which you have heard about. There were oil lamps in the public rooms and candles for the bedrooms, and the staff had to trim the lamps and mess about with the wicks and clean the globes and clean up the candle grease. And to that were added Aladdin and Tilly lamps. Now, by 1933, it was obviously something better was required. So Mrs. McBride bought herself an acetylene gas plant, which was going cheap somewhere. And that included all the water immersion. You know, acetylene is stuff you put into water and it produces gas, and you put it through pipes and so on. They used to use it in other places. They used to use it, in fact, on cars and bicycles and things. They got the little acetylene lamps on them. Anyway, she bought three storage tanks that were 6 foot in diameter approximately, and all the necessary lead piping and the burner fittings for the entire hotel. You know, old-fashioned gas fittings and so on that you had little chains dangling out of and so on. For some reason, she didn't get around to doing this. The tanks, I don't know what happened to all the tanks. I know one of them was taken down to the caves during the war, and it was set on its side, and there was a plank sat on it so that the person who was on watch out there for enemy submarines or something could keep watch out of the rain. But in any case, lapsed, and eventually all that stuff, all that lead, all those fittings, everything else that was left was stolen by gypsies. But I remember it. And Sergeant McCrudden had some hand in it. But in any case, Sergeant McCrudden wasn't stealing it, he was investigating the thing. So, anyhow, while Mrs. McBride was in Glasgow, one of the things she considered bad was the electric generating equipment in Minnewaska. Well, she thought she could light the whole village. I mean, fortunately, she was talked out of that, because if somebody said, would they ever have paid the bills? Anyhow, there was a public lighting company set up in Ballymena, and the church there had its own generator. and she bought that generator and supplied electricity for lighting only, but it was quite an advance in a remote country area. It was a single cylinder telephone of Wakefield. It drove a dynamo producing 110 volts DC indirectly, or there were also storage batteries. And in 1951, well, that produced light. It didn't produce power of any kind. The only thing that was powered from it was an Electrolux vacuum cleaner, which actually was a 75-volt cleaner. So it went like hell. It went completely mad. But anyhow, it wasn't used much because very soon the batteries became defunct, and any time you wanted power, you had to start the generator, and well, somebody had to be got to start the generator, or Jim Webb wasn't there or something, and it really wasn't very practical. But in 1951, the power came to Cushendun, it was 1951, and that meant that all sorts of other things could be done. You could have, well, everything that electricity will give you could be done. We're rather mixed up here for some reason. In 1925 and until 1951, that's 25 years, food storage and preparation and cooking presented a lot of problems. There were no refrigerators, there were no freezers. Like last night, I fed people here, and they had a very nice meal, and I fed them the meat I bought the summer before last, but I didn't use because I didn't get round to opening. I didn't open because there was so much of a traffic outside there from the building of the tenements that you couldn't have opened. Well, in 1925 and 26 and 27, you didn't have that facility. You had no freezers, you had no ice machines, hot beer, no frozen food, no freezer delivery vans. Food was delivered fresh from local sources. That was one of the great things. Local sources had you as a captive audience. Nowadays you can buy your meat in Cookstown or in Cahir Savine if you want to. And cooked food was kept in a meat safe. The old meat safes were flyproof boxes you kept in a shaded place outside, and if it was a warm summer, well, it was a warm summer. And milk was delivered twice a day and was usually sour by the morning. I mean, milk wouldn't have kept 12 hours in the summer. But Mrs. McBride did have an advantage. She owned a farm across the river, which she called the Hotel Farm. She had cows which she could milk, and she had sheep and pigs, and she could therefore have mutton and pork and hens and chickens and vegetables and potatoes. And, well, you can imagine the nuisance it is with chickens. It's all right now to get a fella to deliver chickens, but I can remember chickens being delivered and or taken over from the farm, shall we say. Duck, bring over 24 chickens, and he'd go up and kill them out of one of the hen houses, and he'd come over here, and there were feathers everywhere. My God, those feathers. But the only advantage all this had of having a farm across the river was that when the war came and there was food rationing and there were food snoops called inspectors, there was all sort of evasion of the rules and regulations, and she could have done all sorts of things. But there were no electric cookers, no grills, no microwaves, toasters, no slicers, mixers, food processors. So you had to have a kitchen maid who lit the fire. There wasn't even a Rayburn or a Naga cooker. There was simply a great big open range with a great big open front to it. And the kitchen maid lit the fire at 6 o'clock in the morning so as to have heat up for breakfast and provide hot water for washing. The toast was made in front of this bloody firebox, and the paint was peeling off the wall at the back from the heat. It ate a whole huge bucket of coal about once an hour, and the heat was absolutely overpowering. After lunch... Now, this was common. After lunch, the fire was allowed to reduce, you see. You had to abandon the thing at some stage. So evening meals were normally cold. You didn't have cookers, and you didn't have... You see, no electric cookers or anything like that, and you didn't want to be keeping the fire going all the time. So you had to let the fire reduce, and you had to put up with the ideas of salads and so on. Nowadays, everyone wants chips, 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 chips. You can't live without chips. They're very impractical to make chips if you had no heat. Now, how do you heat the place? Well, central heating. It existed, but people didn't normally expect their bedrooms to be heated. And again, there's no electricity, no fires, no heaters, no electric blankets, and no blowers, and no super stairs. There were open fires around the place, and people climbed around them. there was domestic water heated by a back boiler. There's actually some heaters upstairs that were bought from the Nawaska. They're copper things with wound elements on them, on strips of mica. They're quite interesting things, but they're very impractical. In any case, there was no electricity before 1935. What do you do with the beds? We have stone hot water bottles, and I still have one. It's a lovely thing, and it stays hot all night, and it still warms your feet in the morning. None of those stupid rubber things. The trouble is, of course, they tend to leak and fizz a certain amount. But the chambermaids filled the bottles up at 8 o'clock, and they put the bottles on trays, and they carried them upstairs, and they turned down the beds, closed the curtains, and all the rest of it. In the morning, the chambermaids had to get the water and bring it up in jars up to the rooms so that people could wash themselves. That was before they got the hot and cold in 1935. But it's very labour-intensive and very unsatisfactory, though it had its moments. There were a couple of rooms with fireplaces. You could pay extra to have the fire lit in your room. If it was too hot at night, you couldn't get chilled beer or any of that nonsense. So what did people do all the day? Well, let's first of all, we'll talk about the laundry first. What do you do about laundry? No washing machines, no spin dryers, no tumble dryers, no electric irons, and no presses. So you had to have somebody to do all that. And there was no easy available local laundry. They had big tubs and those ribbed washboards. And then they got a washing machine, which was a square container about that size with a lid on it. And there was a sort of a plunger went in and a handle that you went round and round like that for, and you muddled the thing up. And then you had to dry the things. Well, if you have to dry 4 dozen sheets, where do you dry them? You take them up and spread them and wind bushes up the hill there if you can. But it's not easy. They did, of course, have a great big mangle for getting the water out of it. Ironing was done with, do you remember, there was flat irons. They heated them on the range, and they also had box irons that they could use. Later on, they got Kaller gas irons. There's one upstairs in my museum. A big heavy tube on it, but at least it was controllable and came off a Kaller gas tank. And there were also tilly irons. There's one of those upstairs in my museum too. You pumped it up and it leaked paraffin oil and it smelled the clothes, but at least there was some means of controlling it. 1952, we get the electricity and we get the irons. It's unbelievably different when you get the irons. So what did people do? Well, people came here. They came on the bus, shall we say, and they stayed around. They went to the beach every day, and if it was bad, well, I don't know what you did in bad weather. But then, of course, everybody remembers the beautiful summers there were in the 1930s. It never rained, you know, in the 1930s. But in those times, people came on a holiday. They tended to come together at the same time, and they met up, and they entertained each other to some extent. They did things together. Nowadays, somebody who comes here comes in a car, they go to their own room. They have to have television, of course. Everyone's television in their own rooms. They want also tea-making facilities. The result is they go to their own rooms, they never meet each other, they never get to know each other, and they only stay a couple of days anyhow. It's an entirely different thing. But one of the great advances in those days was tennis. Anybody for tennis. And anybody who was anybody had a tennis court. The Glendon Hotel down below had a tennis court, and we had a tennis court, and the Glens of Antrim and Cushion all had a tennis court, and there were tennis courts all over the place, and people played tennis all day if they couldn't do anything else. In the evening, they all gathered in the drawing room, and many people would bring their own instruments, say violins and so on. A lot of people could play pianos. Well, they were the class of person who played piano anyhow, you see. And there was a certain amount of entertainment. You didn't go out to the pubs. You didn't dash out the door and stay out and come in at 2 o'clock in the morning, because the pubs closed at 9 o'clock in the countryside until 1958, I think it was. Closing time was raised until 10 o'clock. And there, later on, it was raised about 1972 to 11 o'clock, and well, it's half 11 now. And in fact, one of the big changes was that a person after 1958 who was resident in a hotel was deemed to be at home so he or she could drink the 24 hours round. Not in the bar, of course, in her own, in a proper place in the hotel, but they were entitled to drink, and they were also entitled to buy a drink for any friends who came in, but of course the friends couldn't buy a drink back. It was a one-way thing, because after all, guests don't ask their hosts don't ask their guests to buy a drink. If there had been room, I would have let you poke through the visitors' books. There are, I have a collection of them here. I might put them out there later on. You can have a look at them if you ever get time. But they're very delicate. I wouldn't like anyone to poke about at them. Nowadays, we have to keep a register. A register is a different thing from a visitor's book. A visitor's book was just a thing people wrote. The register nowadays, you're required by statute to keep a register of everybody who comes and is going to stay the night. And for that, since it's a compulsory book, it's not mannerly to poke about through the register, since you never know who might have been staying with whom, who didn't want to be seen to be staying with whom. And it just wouldn't be right. There were interesting names in it, like Lord Craigavon, for example, and Eamon de Valera. Now, they didn't all stay at the same time. But there are interesting things, and people look for their own names in the place. Now, I was going to talk about who was here, and I've lost the list, have I? Yes. Well, I mentioned Lord Craigavon and de Valera here. There's a lady called Mercedes Glites came to stay here about 1929. She was swimming the Channel, of all things, and apparently she stayed about a long time. It suited Mrs. McBride to have her here because it, gave publicity to her hotel. Quite a useful thing. In 1934, there was a gentleman called Hallam L. Movius came here. Where did he go to? Hallam L. Movius was an interesting fellow. He was from Harvard. He was leading the third Harvard archaeological expedition. He came to undertake a dig north of the first bend of the river up there. Just up the river, you turn right, up past the bridge, and then the next thing you turn right. And up there he found his site. The members of the dig stayed here. The Cushendun site, which he excavated, represented a very significant Stone Age sequence in which the complete development of early post-glacial culture in Ireland is revealed, from the beginning of human occupation in the Mesolithic era until Neolithic times. The dig lasted from the 28th of July until the 5th of September. The trouble was, it was very stormy and there was a lot of rain at the time, and they had great difficulty with it, but they did get it done. And there were, in fact, other test pits and clearings were made at various sites up along the valley floor to determine the extent of the lagoon shore. The river, the sea, used to be 35 and 50 feet higher, or the ground was 35 feet or 50 feet lower, whichever way you want to look at it. But there was a different height, and that whole glen was filled with water. It was, in fact, a big lagoon, and people lived along the sides of it. And test sites were dug up there to, well, partly to look for artifacts and partly just to see what sort of soil was there and so on. But it was a way of calculating or estimating how and how long people had lived here and in what conditions they had lived. There's now no trace of the site beyond the fact that last year the National Trust made a path through it, and it was easy to see where it had been because that particular place was much softer than the more consolidated area which hadn't been interfered with. The report of the work and conclusions are found in the Proceedings of the Royal Irish Academy. There's I have a book about it, and it showed that Cushendun was a major export route for flint axe for the flint axe factories at Tibulia, inland above Cushendall. The Movius expedition, I've never heard anybody talk about it, but it is quite an interesting thing. There's the question of the Devil's Rock. The cast for the Devil's Rock stayed here. What was the Devil's Rock? The Devil's Rock was a film which was made in Cushendun and Glenarm. It was one of a series of films. Richard Hayward was one of the chief actors in it, and there were others. If I could find some trace of it here. There was a lady came in some years ago, not that long, maybe 10 years ago, and she wanted to see the room in which she had stayed. She was Marjorie Mitchell. She was a sister, actually, of Charles Mitchell, who used to be an announcer on Radio Television Erin. And she had stayed here. She was a very young girl in it at the time, and she was an elderly lady when she came here to see it again. And I showed her the video of it, because Terry Walsh had got me a video of it. Terry Walsh's father, Mr. Walsh, had owned 14 cinemas. Supreme Cinemas was the chain of cinemas. And they found a copy of The Devil's Rock in one of the old cinemas when they were selling it. It used to be the practice in cinemas to keep a collection of spare films lying about the place in case the film which they had ordered hadn't turned up and they needed to show something, step into the breach, and they kept that as a reserve. And he got it put onto a video for me. There are many scenes about the main street and the beach and in the region of the caves down there. The final crisis in the film occurs down at the caves, where a lady stands out on a rock, and, well, there's difficulty with the fact that sometimes she's standing on the rock and sometimes the rock is so submerged that she's up to her waist in the water, just almost immediately afterwards. But, I mean, those sort of things happen in films. One of the most interesting things were that there's a man in it who is busy courting this lady, and he said at one stage, "You know, darling, I know it wouldn't make any difference to you, but I do happen to be able to afford almost anything you might desire." That's really absolutely sickening. The trouble about one of the difficulties with The Devil's Rock was that Richard Hayward did his own singing. He'd be far better at singing. He'd have been far better to have done it, to have got somebody else to do it. But there are some very nice scenes in it, like the rounding up of the sheep up at Claddy Bridge and the music and so on. And it really is nice. It's absolute rubbish, but it is nice. Then in 1941, 42 maybe, there was a school here. There's a section here from the Irish News, somewhere in the Glens on Tuesday. "I spent a day," writes an Irish News reporter, "in very pleasant surroundings. I was a guest at a hotel here, or what had formerly been a hotel. Instead, however, of the sounds of English and American visitors that resounded throughout the spacious building, the laughter and noise of happy children. I was in Harding Street Christian Brothers Technical School, Belfast, removed as a unit to this beautiful spot of comparative safety. Situated on the seafront about 60 miles from Belfast, the new school is indeed flourishing, and everywhere I went I saw smiling, eager young faces. Faces that held no haunted looks of terror as they gazed skywards, but faces, as they should be, for the joys of living and free from worry in a Christian Brothers school. There are in this school about 160 pupils altogether, 140 of whom are boarders. In this peaceful spot they are continuing their studies. They are thoroughly fed and all show, I was told, a physical well-being and contentment which undoubtedly leads to intellectual improvements. The hours of work and play are changed. There's a long break during the day between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. During this time the boys bathe, play games and fish. Then study from 2:30 to 4:30, not a break until some time or other which is lost here, and then prayers and bed at 9. A very full day indeed, but one which will lead them to make better use of, to make them better suited for later life. Some of the boys have got the plot fever and are seen here each day industriously digging away. There's a full staff of teachers, 4 Christian brothers and 4 lay teachers, actually one more than in Harding Street, because an extra brother had to be brought from Dublin to look after the domestic affairs and the health of the boys, and his good work is quite evident. Reverend Bob Brady, Superior of Belfast, is a very frequent visitor, and to him must go the praise for securing the school and for the well-being of his pupils. The boys are now in their third month of residence under Reverend Brother Burgess, Acting Superior. I was told I should have been here on a Sunday, Parents' Day. Many buses arrived from Belfast with mothers and fathers, all anxious to see their children, but quite content to leave them under the excellent care they know they will receive. As I left this school amidst the comparative beauty, and two sounds remain with me are the laughter of the boys and the splashing of the waves against the beach. That was after the Blitz in Belfast. It was decided at that stage to evacuate the school, and it was taken here. That meant, of course, that a lot of work, a lot of things had to be taken and put in the attic, because if you're 160 boys tramping about this building, you can imagine what it would be like after 2 or 3 years. It was handed back, of course, to the McBrides during the summer. They could conduct the summer activity, but it was used for the school during the winter. Another thing which happened here was parts of the building were requisitioned during the war for troop accommodation. That led to difficulties. There's a part of this building here. I'm told there's a hole in that ceiling because somebody discharged a firearm. I have never been fit to find it. And there's supposed to be a hole in the room above, and I've never been fit to find it. I don't believe it ever happened. But anyhow, troops were accommodated in here and up there and down in the low garage. But the bar in between was kept with the McBrides and part of the catering accommodation up there. Now, that famously led to a difficulty, that there was a sentry out there between the two sets of soldiers. And there's a very Republican lady who's now in the Glendun, Maggie Mae MacKillop. And Auntie Kathleen sent her down to go from up there past the sentry down to the bar. Of course, he says, "Halt!" And he says, "I'm not stopping for no English bastard." So they arrested her and took her in, and Auntie Kathleen had to go down and persuade them that she just wasn't all in it, you know, a bit simple and not really. But the man was very concerned that he called her an English bastard. Then we had a very famous gentleman staying here, Mr. Walsh. You might remember Terry Walsh and Mr. Walsh. Mr. Walsh worked on the Titanic. He was born in Achnacloy, and he told me one time that his grandmother, remembered the troops coming home from the Battle of Waterloo. And his family eventually went to Armagh, and they had a business there, quite a good business. They sold so that he could test them in field conditions at a certain distance from their test place in England. And he got more and more interested in the thing and was a very expert wireless operator. Later on, he started his own business in Armagh, building radio sets. Now, in 1925 or 26, the way you didn't go into a shop and buy a set. You had to contact a firm and say, "Please build a radio for me." They came along with some sort of a container, and they got a table, and they built with all the bits and pieces spread out over the table, and the battery somewhere there, and something else there, and something else somewhere else, and they tuned it in, and you got it going. And he sent people all over the north of Ireland building radios. He told me one time that you could, in fact, charge £50 at that time for building a radio, and the cost of the materials was only a fiver. So he was in business in a big way. Then he got into the cinema business, and in their heyday, he was the main owner of the Supreme Cinemas, and he was the first person in Ireland to show a talking film, a sound film. He imported special equipment from America for it, and in 1929, the talkies just started in 1929, he says he imported the first talking film to Ireland and showed it for the first time in Ireland. He had, of course, married, and he lived in Cushendun eventually. He continued the interest in the ham radio all his life. You could hear him. He had a house up between here and Knocknacarry to Gola, where these enormous rigs and antennae and all sorts of stuff like that. His call sign was well known, German 84 Romeo Yankee, GI4RY. And he would come down and tell you about who he'd spoken with, the people like King Hussein and so on. He spoke to them. And later on, when it became possible to buy mobile sets, he bought them and had them in the car, and he used to sit up on the top of the mountain there talking to people in Australia and so on. He pursued that. His wife died in 1955, and about 1965, he decided that he really wanted to live in a hotel, so he came to live here. Effectively, he lived here for half the year, and the other half of the year he lived in Scally's, in Mrs. Scally's. But he did keep the house, and he kept his radio up there, and he went out to play with his radio every day. And he died, he was 94 when he died in Cushendall Hospital. He told me one time, actually, never to live too long, because he was 94, and life was a bit miserable towards the end. Probably the longest serving visitors we had here were the Sloanes and the Harbisons. Miss Sloane, Isabel Sloane, came here in 1925. I think I told you that because her brother had been selling materials. And I think she was coming until about 1980. And then she died. And the Harbisons died too. What else can I tell you? I told you about the Minnewaska. I told you about the furniture, and I told you about everything, and I told you about our guests, or some of them anyhow. The heyday of hotels are over. I listed a whole lot of hotels to you there. You know that nowadays there are very few hotels in Larne. Mrs. Pickering came here again this year. She stayed in the Queen's Hotel in Leeds. She got a flight over to Belfast City Airport. She got a taxi. She asked to go to York Street. The man took her to Central Station, naturally enough. What was the point of going to York Street? And she got the train to Larne, and then she got a taxi to Ballygally Castle, because she had discovered that it still exists. It is an achievement now to find a hotel that still exists. She had read an advertisement for it in an English paper. Well, the man there, the manager there, was quite clever, really, because she got her dinner, and he helped. He went out and made sure she caught her bus, and he helped her out with her luggage, including her black plastic bag, which contained her shoes, her hot water bottle, and her bottle of brandy. He was making sure that he got rid of her, because he was dead scared of getting stuck with her. When she did arrive in Cushendown, she made the bus man reverse the bus down the front here so she could get out of the front door in the proper way. She's a rather eccentric lady. People might say things about drink and so on. Drink doesn't do you a bit of harm if you're to go in Mrs. Pickering's example. She drinks a certain amount of brandy. She asked me to get her a bottle of brandy, a half bottle of brandy, and I could only find her a quarter bottle one day. And she said, "What is that?" And I said, "It's a quarter bottle, Mrs. Pickering." She says, "We never had the likes of that in our house." So, but she then announced she was going to go to Mass. And I said, "Mrs. Pickering, I'll take you to 11 o'clock Mass in Cushendall. You can come with me in the car. I'll take you." She says, "I have to bring my brandy." And I said, "You can't sit in Mass drinking brandy, Mrs. Pickering." She says, "The priest at home says it's all right." I said, "It's not all right. You can't sit in the church in the middle of Mass drinking brandy in Cushendall. I don't care what you do in Hull." So she said, "But I go outside and take the odd sip." I said, "You can't go outside taking the odd sip of brandy. There's about 30 or 40 clowns hanging about the door out there. And you get, what would that look like?" She said, "Well, then I'll not go." Well, I said, "That's all right. You can go twice at home, but you're not going to be running out of, you're not going to run out of Mass drinking brandy and travelling with me, and that's all there's to it." So, hotels are history to a large extent. Nobody would have them. They live on the bar. The typical layout of a hotel, even in those days, was that there were a fairly big building. The family ran it. It was before the days when girls had their own career, so they were made to work in them. There was almost always a husband who had a proper full-time job, and he was made to do the bar in the evening. They never had to buy another house, because they could usually manage to live in it. There wasn't that much trouble paying for education, probably. And they never had to pay a mortgage on a house or anything like that. But they did have the appearance, because in fact they had the man with a full-time job and the free family help. The Bay Hotel down there had three adults working in it. Betty and Naomi Elliott and the Greggs, and they made a living, I presume. My grandmother here had a husband who was actually a retired police sergeant and had a police sergeant's pension. She also had a full good going pub over there. She also had a farm of a kind, so she mightn't have made much money in it. And when she died, she didn't leave a bean. The place was absolutely bunged with people. It was the best going hotel in the Antrim Coast, but it didn't make a bean. And that's how all hotels were, and that's why they're all closed. Right? Anybody want to ask any questions? Thank you.
I'm really scared to ask any questions, so they set themselves right.
No, don't. I'm sure you're fed up. I'm sure you're fed up listening to me, people. Oh, the Sea View. Yes, Morrison's or Goyer's. Absolutely. Absolutely. I make all the notices myself, you see.
Must be hotels in your blood. Your great grandfather owned the
Antrimarm. Oh, yes. Paid £80 for it. And my great grandmother lived in the Royal, and they said she had a brothel there.
Right, can we one more question, please?
I think they're bored listening to me.
No, we didn't have a projector today, but I think it was one of the most illustrative lectures. And I'd like to call upon Dominic here to close it with a thanks.
I'm nearly scared. Thank you, Randall. The first night for a bike here about 3 years ago, I was used to lifting the chairs after the lectures, and I says, Randall, I'll put those chairs away. And you said to me, even if I told you how, you wouldn't do it right, so just leave them away. Relatively short notice must be one of the most informative and certainly the most humorous way to listen to in a long, long time. There was such a wealth of information in it, and there is such a number of questions you could ask, and I don't want to ask too many questions about it. Now, but just observe that Irish news reporter there, he was either paid by the Christian Brothers or had no ideas about it. One of the joys and some other fancy thing about him, but he certainly hadn't much idea anyhow. Randall, there was just one thing I was wondering there about, why there many Scottish visitors here at a certain period?
Yes, there were a lot of Scottish visitors because traditionally a lot of people from here emigrated to Scotland, particularly Glasgow and so on, and settled there. And for that reason, there were still a lot of family connections. There were, what do they call it now, VFRs, visiting friends and relatives. The tourist board called them VFRs. A lot of people came for that reason, because they did have local connections here. They did have the ancestral connections. And the place was bunged with Scots people. The Glasgow Fair, you see, attracted them. We used to have to put up with, first of all, the 12th fortnight, and then the Glasgow Fair afterwards. Sometimes they overlapped, and that was a total nightmare, of course. But the place would have been full for a fortnight with Glasgow people. I can remember one particular time that 70 people stayed here. I don't know how they fitted 70 people into this building, but they did it. You wouldn't do it nowadays. That's the reason for the Scotch visitors.
Just one other question, Ron. What number of staff would it have taken to have operated the whole place?
You could have had 15 to 20 of them kicking about the place on occasions. It was when you would have two, probably four waitresses and two chambermaids at least, and then half a dozen messing about the kitchen, you know, between boys for the yard and things like that. All those things. You couldn't even get the potatoes peeled. You know, you had to peel them by hand. Nowadays we have electric peelers, except, of course, yesterday I was peeling potatoes and the bloody peeler started to smoke on me. It'd been that long since I used it, the belt was slipping and it smoked, but actually once it dried out, it was all right.
Well, I don't want to take up any more time this thing. There's other activities coming along. But on behalf of everybody here, I would like to thank Randall for a quite brilliant lecture. Thanks.
But I even tend to suggest that this might be a fixture. Randall, have another topic for this time next year. It would be well received, but we'll not push you on that one tonight.
I don't think so.